Thanks very much, Brian. I appreciate that, and thanks to Peter Schramm as well, and Bill Campbell for putting this all together for us. Dr. Kessler raises an important claim in his talk, and I'm going to say something about the topic he brought up at one point, the moral exhaustion of liberalism. What is liberalism? I'm not going to be able to answer that question, but I think one can say that on the surface, at any rate, liberalism seems to be a continuation of the earlier progressivism. And in fact, the discussion this afternoon at the 4 o'clock panel seemed to very much to assume that contemporary liberalism was an outgrowth or an extension of original progressivism. By original progressivism, I mean the theory and political programs of people like Theodore Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, and John Dewey, the earlier 20th century. Those progressives could be said to have reached their zenith, or that view of policy could be said to have reached its peak in 1964-65 in the great legislative achievements of the Great Society, with the Civil Rights Act, Medicare, Medicaid, food stamps, and the rest of the LBJ Great Society program. In foreign policy, at that same time, the Vietnam War was being fought in the name of the old progressive ideal. Lyndon Johnson explained that the war was part of, quote, a worldwide attack on the problem of hunger and disease and ignorance. He literally did attempt to fight the war as an extension of the Great Society to the Third World. In this pre-65 period, progressive confidence in its theory and agenda was boundless. Progressives had no doubt that the spread of their power and influence was a tremendous benefit to the world and to Americans at home as well. Early progressives like Senator Albert Beveridge thought that progressivism, as he called it, was part of God's plan, and in fact, that the Americans were God's chosen people, a claim that he frequently made in his speeches. Something changed in the 1960s, though, just when it seemed that liberalism was triumphant. Almost overnight, doubts regarding the superiority or even the basic decency of the West and of America in particular began to infect liberal politicians and intellectuals. The Vietnam War protests showed this most obviously, but the disillusion ran deeper than that. America was increasingly condemned in liberal circles as an imperialist, racist, sexist, and elitist. What prepared the way for this liberal crisis of confidence, mostly unnoticed at the time, was that liberal theorists had gradually been abandoning their earlier faith in American and progressive goodness. They had given up their belief in the foundations of liberalism, in the ideas of science, and in the theory of historical progress. Liberalism after 1965 kept going. It didn't quit, but it changed in important ways. If we take the current examples of Iraq and Afghanistan today, in both nations, the United States is currently propping up a corrupt regime that incorporates Islamic law into their U.S.-approved constitutions. In both governments, persecution of Christians is an everyday fact of public policy. And yet the United States, in spite of the fact that it is funding both of these governments to the tune of multiple billions of dollars a year, feels unable to put up more than a token resistance or protest to policies of this sort. The earlier progressive belief that America knows best what is good for underdeveloped nations would have led to a very different result. The earlier progressives would simply have said, we are going to impose upon you for your own good the correct kinds of policies, and you will not be persecuting people anymore. This older progressive confidence has been replaced by a timid acceptance of whatever laws and customs happen to prevail, even if those traditions lead to policies that Americans themselves regard as evil. Now, there are three that's my example of the contemporary change of mood. There are three topics which I think illustrate nicely the difference between the older confident progressivism and the postmodern, post-1960s liberalism. And I'm going to talk briefly about each of those three: science, sex, and progress. First, in regard to science, today's liberals are ambivalent about science, whereas the progressives had infinite faith that science either had all the answers or that it was on the road to discovering them. Today, although the prestige of science remains very great, it has been greatly diminished by liberal multiculturalism, which sees science as just another point of view. Some intellectuals go even further. For them, Western science is a way of thinking that is profoundly defective. 2 decades ago, in a widely read report, 6 leading humanities professors announced that, quote, the ideal of objectivity and disinterest, which had been essential to the development of science, has been rejected by the consensus of most of the dominant theories of today's academic world. Instead, today's consensus, these scholars said, holds that, quote, all thought develops from particular standpoints, perspectives, and interests, unquote. In other words, there is no possibility of objectivity, of disinterestedness, and therefore there is no truth. Today's intellectuals increasingly dismiss science as a Western perspective on reality, no more or less valid than the folk magic believed in by a Pacific Island tribe or Islamic customs that cover women in garments that make them invisible in public. Second difference. Liberalism today has become preoccupied with sex. In the founders' view, going back to a pre-progressive position, since the protection of the person and property, which is the purpose of government, depends upon the continued existence of the nation, government was expected to as part of its activity of securing these rights, to promote the generation and education of children. Prior to the 1960s, this meant that sex outside of marriage was discouraged by government and by social custom. Today, of course, sexual activity is to be freed from nearly all restraints. Abortion and homosexual conduct are considered fundamental rights. These things are so important that they have been equated by the Supreme Court with the right, quote, to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life, unquote. That's what sex is all about. The progressives on this question tended to follow Hegel, in such, which led them to embrace, more or less, the same perspective as that of the founders with regard to the family. However, there is this connection between sexual liberation and progressivism. There was one premise of progressivism that may be said to have led to the current liberal understanding of sex, and that is the disparagement of nature and the celebration of the human will, the idea that everything of value is created by man's choice and is not given by nature. Once sexual conduct is evaluated in that light, it is not hard to see that government efforts to link sexual expression to marriage and children, the older approach, could easily be seen as an unjustifiable limitation of human liberty. John Dewey favored the term self-realization because for him, the true self was still tied to reason and science. Today's liberalism no longer speaks of self-realization. They speak of self-expression, in the name of which all barriers to sexual idiosyncrasies must appear arbitrary and tyrannical. A third difference between the older progressivism and current liberalism is this: contemporary liberals no longer believe wholeheartedly in the idea of progress. The progressives' faith in progress was rooted in their faith in science, as one can see especially in the European thinkers whom they admire, such as Hegel and Comte. When science is seen as just one perspective among many, then the notion of historical progress itself is called into question. The idea of progress presupposes that what comes later is superior to what happened earlier. But contemporary liberals are reluctant to affirm the superiority of the modern West in any sense. We see this in their disinclination to support any foreign policy venture that contributes to the strength of America or of the West. Instead, liberals favor, and I guess this is very different from progressivism, liberals favor those foreign policy ventures that benefit other nations, but not our own nation, such as the liberation of Kosovo or Libya. Liberal domestic policy follows the same basic principle. It tends to elevate the other to moral superiority over against those whom the founders would have called the decent and the honorable, those who have some claim to wisdom and virtue. The progressive had in common with the founders a respect for the idea that that people who are highly educated and have good character are to be admired and are to be looked up to in society. In the current view, we have the opposite understanding. The more a person is lacking, the greater is his or her moral claim on society. The deaf, the blind, the disabled, the ignorant, the improvident, and even in a 1984 speech of presidential candidate Walter Mondale, the sad. Those who are lowest are entitled to the highest respect and are extolled as the sacred other. A sense of honor in the older sense, still important to the earlier progressives, now counts for little or nothing. What do these changes indicate, then, about the future of progressive liberalism? I believe we are now in a situation where liberalism has abandoned its own foundation, but has not yet confronted this fact. Liberals today are in the same situation as the cartoon character who walks off a cliff but doesn't fall down until he notices that he is walking on air. They haven't noticed yet. Why should liberals care about the downtrodden? That's the question. What made this cause good in the older progressive understanding is that it was supposedly supported by the latest research in social science, research that the progressive intellectuals were working to embody in public policy. But liberals today are no longer sure that science is valid because of the challenge of multiculturalism. The question then becomes, how long can a political movement continue to operate on autopilot without a convincing explanation of why it is morally right to support justice in the liberal sense? Some 60 years ago, Leo Strauss predicted that the more liberalism becomes conscious of its own groundlessness, the less people would remain faithful to the liberal cause. Its logical successor, Strauss argued, is what he called fanatical obscurantism, by which he seemed to mean the turn to increasingly willful and fanatical and self-interested policies grounded either in nihilistic destructiveness or in an irrational religious doctrine. And we see signs in the world today of both of those possible, both of those tendencies. The viable civilizing alternative in the modern world, particularly in America, if I might speak for a moment as a longtime board member of the Claremont Institute, is a return to the political theory of the founding. Thank you.